happy to announce that the Fretboard Journal now has three presenting sponsors. These are three brands that are behind us with everything that we do, including the podcasts and the videos, and they include Carter Vintage. Carter Vintage Guitars, where guitar lovers go for a good time. Gibson Guitars, only a Gibson is good enough. And last but not least, Martin Guitars. Martin Guitars and Strings remain the choice for musicians around the world for their unrivaled quality, craftsmanship, and tone. Can't thank these three brands enough for being presenting sponsors. Thank you, guys. Hey, gang. Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I'm Jason Berlindi, the founder of the Fretboard Journal magazine. As always, that is John Rauhouse playing in the background. That's a tune called Homies Parade. You can find that on Spotify or wherever else you stream music these days. And today on the podcast, I'm talking to the one and only Robert Keeley. As I hope many of you know, I co-host a sister podcast to this one called The Truth About Vintage Amps alongside Skip Simmons. And on that podcast, people email or call us with questions about their vintage amps and sometimes their new amps. And Skip goes off and being the amp guru that he is, helps them out with all of their problems. We had a guy call in with a Echoplex that was making all sorts of funky sounds, and it baffled Skip a little bit. And lo and behold, Robert Keeley, the guy you're about to hear from, called into the show and helped this guy out. I thought that was such a cool move. I was so glad to hear that the folks over at Keeley Electronics are listening to our podcast that I thought I'd invite him on this podcast so we can dig a little bit deeper. And we had a great chat. You know, I probably first saw Robert Keeley's work at Westwood Music down in Southern California like 15, 20 years ago when he was mostly known for modifying tube screamers so that you could sound more like Stevie Ray Vaughan. And these days, he's up to a heck of a lot more. Digital signal processing is the rage, and he has so many pedals that are so complicated. And it was great to hear just how these things originate, how they develop, and hear his workflow, which I think you guys will love. Needless to say, we are in the midst of the holiday craziness here in Seattle at our tiny little Fretboard Journal offices. We've got Andrew Marlin coming in for a video shoot very shortly, and we have boxes and boxes of magazines going out to people around the world. So if you want to subscribe to the Fretboard Journal, get a gift subscription to the Fretboard Journal, or buy some back issues, now is the time. You can use the discount code PODCAST, and I will take $5 off of your orders. And everybody now, we're working hard to get Fretboard Journal 45 all stickered and ready for everybody so that you get it before Christmas. And so I think you will love that issue. We also now have pre-orders available for the Electric Guitar Annual, our second ever Electric Guitar Annual. Once again, we're doing an anthology of previously unpublished, never before seen electric guitar articles. This is not included in your regular Fretboard Journal subscription. I know a lot of Fretboard Journal readers are acoustic purists and would get upset at me if I sent them a magazine filled with stories on effects pedals and amps and electric guitars. But you can order it as a digital edition or as a print edition, and that'll be mailing out right around the first of the year. Our first sponsor for this week's podcast is Mono Cases. You can go to monocreators.com to see their entire line of gig bags, pedal boards, you name it. They are up to so much cool stuff, and that's just with the Mono brand, because they also are the same parent company is resurrecting Harmony and Tysco and doing all sorts of other cool stuff. So go to monocreators.com, see their entire lineup. We just had Rachel and Vilray over here, an amazing jazz duo. Rachel is the Rachel from Lake Street Dive, and it was cool to see Vilray's beat-up Mono case that housed his Squire Telecaster from the 80s. We also are sponsored once again by our friends over at Retrofret Vintage Guitars. Retrofret just had a holiday party, not just any holiday party. Bill Kirchin was playing at it. You know, every week on this podcast, I try to go through their new arrivals page and tell you about cool stuff. Guess what? Some of the cool stuff, by the time I get around to the next week's podcast, is already on hold. So go to retrofret.com, follow their Instagram, see what they're up to. Right now, they've got one of Walter Becker's micro frets guitars. It's a six-string bass baritone. They've also got a late 60s National Prototype Archtop. It's like their version of a Super 400. This is actually a guitar that we're going to be writing about in a future Fretboard Journal. And guess what? It's already on hold, so you can't get that one. But they've got so much cool stuff. And if your name is Ronnie, or you know someone named Ronnie, they've got a 56 Martin D18 that is for you. It's Ronnie inlaid in cursive on the fingerboard with a double pickguard action. It's a total bluegrass Nashville guitar. Somebody needs to nab that. Go to retrofret.com, see their entire lineup of everything that they do, all their new arrivals. They do amazing repair and restoration work as well. What else can I tell you? We have a ton of new videos on fretboardjournal.com. We have a new Luthier on Luthier podcast with Sam Guidry that I encourage you all to check out. And as I said, we've got that Truth About Vintage Amps podcast that I've been doing. Tune into that if you haven't yet. We are celebrating our one-year anniversary. We're posting an episode, and we reached out to Larry Cragg, Neil Young's guitar tech as well. And maybe most importantly for any of you bargain hunters out there, we are giving away a Stumac Champ kit on the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast. So you want to follow us at Vintage Amps Podcast on Instagram. Look for the picture of the shiny new Champ amongst all the old guitars. And you can read details on how you can enter to win that. We have a couple weeks left before we give that away. And we've got all sorts of other surprises too. So check out the Truth About Vintage Amps. Check out one of our recent episodes if you want to see what all the fuss is about. Even if you are not an amp nerd, I promise you, you will find this entertaining, mainly because of Skip Simmons, my co-host. I'm just the straight man on that podcast. All right. Without further ado, here is my talk with Robert Keeley of Keeley Electronics. Up to so much cool stuff. This is not necessarily my world, the world of effects pedals, but I learned so much, and Robert is like the greatest instructor, teacher imaginable in terms of walking a Luddite like me through how all this stuff goes down. So I hope you will enjoy this interview. Robert, so we're talking right now, it's early December, NAMM is a month and a half away. You guys always have a ton of stuff coming out all the time. But where are you at right now with your product cycle? Are you able to take December to kind of just ship everything? Or are you always tinkering, always engineering, always figuring out what's going on?
Around here, it's only a number of milliseconds before NAMM. It's not months before NAMM.
Yeah.
It's milliseconds before NAMM in my mind. And yeah, I'm the type of engineer that's always learning from my mistakes. So no, we're designing, we're correcting problems, fixing things, and trying to make everything better up to the last second. That's just kind of the way it rolls around here. So I have got so many different fields that come together to produce a pedal that it's a lot of the excitement bouncing around and getting everything dialed in for this NAMM show. In the past, I had taken an approach where I wanted to get several ear-catching pieces out there, and the ideas weren't fully developed, and then I suffered if I couldn't make everything wrapped up in a pretty bow in a certain number of months. So this is the last time. This is the last time that we will ever go to a show not fully prepared. So this time I'm feeling really good because we are in just the final, millimeters of things. And it's really exciting. It's been a push for our whole team. It's been a push for years to develop our new Echoes pedal, which is a culmination, again, of so many different disciplines and areas of manufacturing and musical instrument gear and stuff like that. That's how we are. We're running around like crazy, you know, the month beforehand. But I think that everything will wrap up here and I'll be sitting pretty to be actually working on next year's stuff here shortly.
Okay. Can we use, since this whole world of pedal building is sort of mystical to me. I understand when you tear apart an old fuzz face or something, you can see kind of the inner workings. But can we use this Echoes pedal R&D process development as sort of a roadmap of how these things come to you in mind, and then how they actually, can you walk us through the entire process, at least quickly, of how this the kernel of the idea all the way to the finished product that shows up at NAMM?
Yep, I sure can. So, it changed a lot for me when, or it changed significantly for me when we started to incorporate DSP in our designs. So, just prior to that, we had gotten some CNC machines and we had gotten some powder coating, and we were taking on more and more of the manufacturing effort of our pedals. At that point in time, with those tools like these LED printers and the CNC and the powder coating, I could craft a pedal design shortly after it just popped into my head. So if I was driving down the road thinking, "Hey, man, wouldn't it be great to get a Beatles sound?" And I remember Aaron talking about, my DSP programmer. I remember Aaron talking about this 30 millisecond delay line, and ideas could literally come together in a week because we had eventually set ourselves up for being able to program on a circuit board platform that allowed us to put a bunch of ideas down, sound effects down, and adjust the programming or adjust the circuitry. But we created the circuitry with these kind of modifications in mind. So when you say, how do you come up with pedals? It sure has been a fun road because it went from, hey, what kind of analog pedals can I modify the frequency response or the tone of? And all the way in a number of, say, 5 years, then being able to go, well, I'd like to have this reverb from this sound, and I'm going to put that together with this vintage fuzz sound, and I'll be able to, exaggerate these things. So the ideas come as kind of as fast as I'm chasing sounds. I hear something I like, or someone reminds me. That's what usually happens. Someone's like, "Hey, I was listening to this," and I'm like, "I know, isn't that the greatest sound? How can we do that? How can we create that here instead of, whatever kind of studio techniques they might have had to do?" So the ideas can come and be manifested very quickly. We've done things. I swear we've done pedals in a week or two. We've done pedals while artists have come to visit us, because we can set ourselves up for implementing an idea that we could code in DSP, and we have a circuit board platform that supports, all kinds of things, whether it's a wet, all wet effect like a phaser might be, or a distortion might be, or a blended effect like delays and reverbs. So that's how fast they can come about. We can sit around and talk about Capitol Records and the reverb chambers that Les Paul made there and designed, and go, "Hey, what if we did this? What if we, put a surf vibe to it, and just as fast as I'm just dreaming up an effect pedal for you right now, like how can we combine spring reverb and Les Paul's ideas at Capitol Records into one box?" You know what I mean? And give somebody a tremolo, and then we need to add a tremolo, and it'll be a cool little, Capitol twang.
You make it sound easy, but I'm guessing there is, it's not easy.
It is not easy. My guys work super hard here. They put up with me demanding and pushing on them all the time because we have engineers and we have media directors and we have artist relations people that are constantly involved, and they're constantly under my, the ideas as fast as I can spit them out and daydream with them, and then they start coming back to me with great ideas, and next thing we're tied up in a bunch of events and we're having to work hard and work fast, and this has got to be approved, that's got to be approved, and the circuit has to pass this kind of testing, and we have to get the manuals translated. So all that effort actually, continues to accelerate the excitement and take away from the ease of it, but it's fun. It's not that it's easy. It's actually quite challenging, and everybody works very hard at this level, where we are growing really well, So It's both easy because I've got so much help from so many people, but it's hard because the jobs that they're doing are actually really challenging, you know, for our area, you know, our position in our development.
When it comes to this transition that you made and you know, kind of outlined getting the CNCs, the digital signal processing, was there a point where you realized there are some things, you know, you started out building compressors and modding pedals and building amps. Was there a point where you're like, oh, I can't do this. I need to hire this engineer to do what we're, are there some things that you just can't do in the terms of making of a pedal right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a great question. You ask good questions. So part of me has always been part of Robert Keeley and Keeley Electronics has always had this incredible lazy streak. So even some of the very first compressors, I'm talking less than serial number 10.
Okay.
Were actually built by students of mine that I was teaching at this private college. So even right from the get go, I was like, hey, any of you guys want to make some extra money?
You were outsourcing. All right.
I was outsourcing already because I was like, this looks too much like work to me. But it does allow me to manage then more people because as soon as I get somebody to actually build them, then I can get somebody to drill the cases now. And then I can do this and I can get this person to do this. So as an engineer, I actually don't always do the nitty gritty hard and cool engineering of our projects here. There's, you know, Creighton does the circuit boards, that both the schematic and the design and the layout of all our circuits. And, you know, along the way, he went from, you know, just starting engineering school to where we're doing, you know, multi-layer DSP boards with memory and multiplexers and a bunch of features. And once we started developing board skills, then it was like, okay, well, now we need to develop DSP programming skills. So the guy that Aaron Tackett, the guy that helped me set up the CNC machine so we could drill more cases, was like, hey, that business is too loud and dirty. Let me get into the programming. And sure enough, you know, 5-6 years later, he's a absolute amazing wizard at programming sounds because he likes the same kind of sounds I do. And we're both turned on by the same sounds and music. So it's a really great relationship that helps foster this. So I kind of get out of the hard stuff, but I'm always there in the background to suggest something. Because I worked in stereo stores, car stereo stores, home audio stores, places that had even then medical equipment or broadcast equipment. So I got to see a lot of gear, you know, specifically made in Japan, Sony, Panasonic, you know, Kenwood and Denon and all those names and all the car stereo name brands like JVC and Kenwood and stuff. So I got to see all that stuff and I got to see how that's one thing that kind of carries through the engineering is the technician side of things. When I worked in the repair stores, seeing how manufacturers had to solve problems and how they built things and whether they lasted or not. You know, if you see a certain type of mounting scheme where the solder connection goes bad, you may try to avoid that when you're making your own pedal. So at any rate, so that's kind of what I do. I kind of just direct in terms of it's my job to daydream the pedals and the concepts. And, you know, I can get it right sometimes, but then I realize the more I listen to the people here at the shop that are 99% guitar players and musicians, they help foster and inform the idea a little bit better. And, you know, then I can direct the engineers to do the pieces that need to be, you know, compiled to make the whole effect. So that's kind of where I stand in between, not actually doing the cool, you know, fingers in the details type stuff, unfortunately or fortunately, one of the two. I do feel guilty sometimes that I don't do more of the nitty gritty stuff, but that's the way it works.
Sure. No, it's working for you.
I love sending these people to school. I mean, I think we're going to have next semester, we'll have 3, 4, 5, at least 5 people going to school. And I think 4 of them as engineers.
So wait, walk me through this. You, your employees, you have a program where if they want to further their education and get deeper into engineering, you fund it?
I do. And it tends to be, you know, right now, of course, it seems more, you know, definitely family member type heavy. Like my wife's son is going to school. My own son started college last semester. And, but there is Drew Papadopoulos. He's one of our young technicians, but I think he's, you know, sharp as a tack, and he wanted to go to school, and I was like, right on, let's get you there. Just make sure you get this many hours in. And so, yeah, it's not so much disciplines outside, although I've sent people to school for, you know, Adobe type classes and blah, blah, blah. So I really kind of like putting in that kind of effort to educate people. If I can find a good way to cram it into, it's good for work, or I can see how we can make money if we can do it in house and stuff like that. I think I might be going out on a limb more with so many engineers because I don't know that I have the creative whatever behind me to muscle behind me to direct so many engineers, but you know, maybe it'll be somebody else's job by the time they graduate.
Yeah.
To figure out what they have to do.
And for the field that we're talking about, making effects pedals, what kind of school are most folks gravitating towards? What's their focus? I mean, where are folks going for this engineering degree?
Well, there's this local college university, UCO, and here in Edmond, and that's where they go. And they're going for electrical engineering. I think what's nice about electrical engineering, if I can digress, is that it teaches you so much about the physical world, and there's so much math involved. And engineering ends up being kind of like the greatest insurance policy, as I can see it, because you can work in any state, you can work in any country, you can get a job anytime. I mean, there's ultra low unemployment for electrical engineers. Then what's nice about that is that you kind of branch out, and you can go into software, you can go into hardware, you can go into, you know, this, that, computer architecture, cellular wireless communication. So you can start to, you know, specialize your electrical engineering degrees towards your interests. So I consider it like just the greatest insurance policy is you might as well go to school. While you're going to school, you're usually a pretty darn good employee. You got a lot going on in your life. So I just think the whole thing just kind of rings true. And since that's the story I told myself when I was doing it, and that's the story my dad told me, I'm going to continue telling it to these other unsuspecting victims that they should become engineers because it worked for me.
That's cool.
So.
You mentioned working at in the hi-fi industry at hi-fi stores, uh-huh. and obviously your name is synonymous with the modern boutique pedal movement. Was there ever a point when you were in the trenches there where you thought you might go into the hi-fi world more than the world of musicians?
You know, that's funny. I think looking back on that, I think the only thing that I wanted to, that I thought was really cool was actually the early days of car stereo amplification when this company named Rockford Fosgate started in Tempe, Arizona, or, you know, at least they grew up there. I think they were started there. It became a hotbed for car stereo stuff. And those MOSFET amplifiers, when they distorted, they sounded so good. You know, people would just absolutely crank them into distortion and it sounded better, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that was really cool looking at the insides of their product designs. It was all made in America and it just looked so cool and robust. But I never thought like I was going to go, like we'd carry some carry audio or something like that, some kind of fancy tube stuff or, you know, speaker stuff. And I never really caught kind of the bug to make that kind of level of audio equipment. When I caught the bug to actually build something was with the tube amps and things like that, you know, that's when I started trying to actually make something and modify a circuit or, you know, explore how the whole thing works, start to beginning so I could understand it. And the tube amps are the first thing I actually put together a proposal for and asked my boss if I could have money to at the stereo store. Sandy Clemens asked him if I could build and sell amplifiers, you know, even though he was selling car stereos and home theaters, but he didn't quite get it. And he told me no. So that's eventually that's when pedals came along, and I was like, well, these things are simple enough. I could just build them. You know, I don't have to have woodworking skills and, you know, Tolex skills and grill cloth skills.
How many?
All those other things.
How many amps had you made?
Not many. Two?
Two.
Three, maybe. You know, I made a deluxe, I made a bassman, and then I modified them both, you know, extensively. And then I might have made one more deluxe that had a solid state rectifier for some reason. And, but I don't think I modified anything else. Or those weren't modifications. I built them on chassis that were from PAs and stuff like that, like old Bogans or Chicago, you know, whatever. So, no, I didn't build many. I just didn't have the resources. I was still going to school and didn't have money falling out of my pocket. So, you know, making tube amps is kind of expensive if you don't have disposable income. So I couldn't, you know, I dreamed about building tons of deluxes. Like, you know, probably, you know, dreamed about building 100 different deluxes, mm-hmm. but so.
Were you tearing apart old amps too and learning the intricacies of them?
Well, I sold stuff on eBay. So on weekends or whatever, I would go around and I would get equipment from estate sales. This is in the late 90s. So fortunately I could buy stereo equipment, and if it was broken, I could fix it and then sell it on eBay. And since eBay was just firing up, it was huge profit. You know, if I found a Macintosh stereo system at some estate sale, and, you know, gave them all of $35 for it, you know, then life was good. But I could fix the stuff. So I forgot what your question exactly was, but no, I did, you know, I just kept up with the repairing the stuff to sell it or get it out the door and considered myself lucky.
Sure. And you were doing that with guitar amps too?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. All those little Oahus and I can't remember the names now, but those little teeny, you know,
lap seal amps.
Amps with like three tubes, like the, I can't even remember the numbers, like a 50 L6 and a 35 CW5 or whatever, you know, three tube type amps. Yeah, all those things had bad capacitors, so you'd have to replace those or then replace the speaker, find something like that.
Yeah.
Those kind of repairs, you know, bad capacitors, bad resistors, bad tubes.
Sure. So late 90s now we're talking about, you decide that amps are too daunting and too expensive to, as a struggling student, to start creating. You go in the pedal world. What was that first step? What was the first step there?
It was simply I wanted to buy a Ross compressor and didn't have the $400 or whatever they were, up to $800 on eBay at the time, to get a Ross compressor. So then I saw the schematic online and I was like, oh man, that's so simple. I could put that on a Radio Shack perf board. Not so simple. It was complex enough that it would just barely fit on the perf board, and built it. I remember thinking back to when I was in high school, and I remember the first time I played a compressor in a music store was an Ibanez CP9. And I thought it was the most horrible thing you could do to a guitar signal. It just immediately struck me as making whatever kind of Ibanez Roadstar Series 2 guitar I was playing sound horrible. The humbuckers overloaded the compressor and it just sounded lifeless and dead. And I couldn't even figure out how it was giving me more sustain. So I was just like, oh, that's a horrible effect. When I knew what to listen for in the compressor effect, and then I knew how it added sustain, and then I wanted to hear one. So I made that copy of the Ross compressor. And when I heard it on a Telecaster through a deluxe amp, and I could hear all the artifacts, and I could then hear it bloom and do all those things that country guys like and blues guys like, that was just kind of mind-blowing that it sounded so darn good. So then I was like, no wonder people like compressors so much. This thing sounds amazing. I had no idea. And I was like, I got to sell this because this thing just sounds magic. And, you know, so it's just the story of a guy just discovering a compressor, but he happened to be able to build them. And so, or had the desire to try to build them after I built the first one. I was thinking, man, people will buy this. And that's how it started, you know, just like that. So it wasn't like I was looking to make pedals my career at all. It was just like, hey, I bet you I can sell one to pay for the parts for this other one.
Sure.
And that's exactly how it went.
And then what was the second product?
Oh, I get confused. It was probably, I think it was the Time Machine Boost, my partnership with David Zabatos, the Legendary Tones. And out of that, I got to design the first circuit element, and that would be what became the Katana Boost, which is just me looking at tube amps and using FETs to kind of replace the tubes, and then two in a simple series. And then I just added some filtering so it didn't sound harsh. And that was the modern side of the Time Machine Boost. And so that was actually my first original design part in that Time Machine Boost. The other side was just the Dallas Rangemaster Treble Booster. And so after the Time Machine Boost had been out for a while, I released it under my own name, Keeley, as the Katana Boost. So that Katana Boost also had some voltage doubling, because I'd been hearing that the Klon, an overdrive pedal, had this voltage doubler in it. So I increased the voltage on the FETs, which made the pedal sound better. You know, the FETs have a little bit different or better distortion if the voltage is a little bit higher than 9 volts. So it kind of worked out really good.
Yeah. How many pedals are you guys currently offering right now?
I have no idea. I really don't. I'd have to go around and look, but I bet you it's between like 25 and 30, maybe.
Yeah.
I bet you it's around there.
Here's a better question.
Website,
go ahead.
There's a website that tracks it, and I was pleased that at some point in time this year I crossed the 100 pedals designed mark. I mean, there's occasionally sometimes where it's just a name difference, you know, but that doesn't happen very often. But it's over 100 pedals that they say we've cranked out. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Here might be a more amusing question. Of all the pedals you've released, was one just a total failure and you thought it was going to be fantastic and embraced by everyone?
That happens every single time.
Clearly it doesn't.
I'm like, guys, this is going to be the one. This is the one that's going to take off. And I'll even do my best trying to talk to all the distributors and retailers and talking them into buying it. And then I'm like, oh, okay, I guess people didn't want that after all. But I can't point to too many specific ones. There are some funny stories, though. I mean, I tried to make a pedal sound like the Blues Driver, but I wanted to do it with my own circuit topology, and that became our Luna Overdrive. I got some crazy bad feedback one day from this guy that was playing in a church, and the church director said it was the worst sound he ever heard. So it crushed my man feelings, and I canceled the pedal. The next day, I swear to God, the next day, I get word from England that they had voted it pedal of the year. After I completely canceled it, stopped all the orders, I'm like, we're done, not making that one. But, you know, some pedals exceed my expectations, and I can tell you that the Caverns does, and the Dark Side does. The Dark Side is a great little pedal that has our own fuzz on it. I wanted to do our take on a, you know, op amp, big muff style pedal. Mm-hmm. And by the time we changed it up, it became its own creature. And that's when Aaron Pierce came in and started helping me dial in the sound of it. And the digital side, we finally had delays down, and we could do the syncopated delay. We could do David Gilmour's flanging sounds and phasing sounds, and we could do all these cool sounds. So I kind of put it together in this concept of a Dark Side pedal in which you could get all those 70s classic rock sounds. So, you know, sometimes they exceed my expectations. Sometimes I think I got it figured out, and it just doesn't seem to take off in the way I thought to, or it might take some time. You know, I'll worry about the designs quite a bit until they're out there, and then I'm trying to figure out how to better it. So I don't know.
I mean,
go
ahead.
No, I'm just saying, I think I'm constantly oscillating between, you know, exuberant excitement and like, oh my God, I have so much I have to do, and get everybody to, you know, learn and figure out how to do this so I can do this.
Sure.
So it bounces around.
I mean, every year I think we've reached peak pedal. I feel like there's more and more pedal makers. When you are doing product development, do you have your eyes on not the competition, but just where the landscape is? And sometimes do you have to decide there are just too many pedals like this? Or do you kind of have a blinders on and just follow your vision?
It's all of those things, because my world is pedals. Believe it or not, I wasn't planning this, but I'm staring at hundreds of pedals in front of me right now, trying to think how to answer the question. I both totally love it when the field is crammed, you know, because it forces me to think and daydream in some other way of how I can be different. And so, you know, overcrowding is inspiring. Also, when I combine ideas, because all the basic operations are done. There's addition, subtraction, division, and multiplication. That's how you make all the sounds that we hear. You know, there's the whole big secret. You can do those four operations, and that's just about it. Throw in maybe an exponential or a logarithmic something, and then you pretty much got it. So then you have to start combining sounds and making sounds trigger other sounds, or you have to make things more dynamic and imitate the human voice. You know, so those are the things where that's how I design and develop the pedals is now, is to try to look at the market, look at the sounds that I like, and how do I recreate those sounds, or how do I give people easier access to the tools. So it's a perfect description of how I've wandered around with the Echoes pedal for the past 3 years that we're getting ready to release here on January 16th, is I, you know, wandered into wanting to do a really nice delay with this flanged echo sound. I was driving down the road one day and I'm like, hey, I don't really like a chorus sound. Isn't there a flanger sound that sounds less pitchy? Sure enough, we hadn't done it. I asked Aaron if we had done it, and he's like, no, we haven't done it. I think I can come up with something like that. Well, come to find out, he has to create two echoes that play at the same time, and one of them ends up being delayed, so that makes the flanger sound. So then we get to wandering around with tape sounds and flanger sounds, and we keep on adding effects until we're like, hey, can't we just add more memory and make it a looper? And then next thing you know, I've, you know, convinced him, hey, we could put a little phrase sampler in there. And then I go, oh, it's not good enough unless we have, you know, somebody's going to cry and complain if we don't have undo in there, and including myself. And then next thing you know, we're, you know, trying to cram that in there and work out those challenges. So that's, you know, I don't know if I answered your question or not, but.
Well, you've made me think of another question, which, you know, the Echoes is a good example of. How do you know when a pedal is done? How do you know? Obviously, NAMM is a nice finite event, or, you know, date in the future where you got to release something, or your stores might get upset. But how do you know when a pedal's done? How do you know when to say, all right, we got to stop cramming features into this?
Mm-hmm. I know that's the lesson I'm taking right now, so I'll probably have to get back to you on that one, because I can tell you with the Echoes, I was joking around in our manager's meeting. I was like, you better get this thing out of my hands, because I'm trying to convince somebody to put a little Easter egg inside the pedal now that we've got all the difficulties ironed out and it does everything I wanted it to do. How can I sneak some other features in there that you know I might not tell people about? So when you ask when is it done, that's when you actually have the stamp on the box and you're like, okay, bye-bye. I guess I'm done with you for a while. So that's, but I don't like to change the designs after they're out.
Okay.
I don't know what that is, but I don't necessarily live with mistakes. I'll make sure that the mistakes, any mistakes, are corrected, but I try not to modify or change anything. For example, I never changed any mods that I did to the TS9. If it has a mod plus, it's the same as it was on day one, as it was on the very last day that we modded two screamers. And I don't change the compressor, you know, over the years at all either, unless we come out with a new version. So I don't change the programming in pedals, if I decide I like something differently. I really try not to do that because I want them to be consistent from unit to unit. I didn't want someone to say, hey, I got this old Keeley and it sounds good compared to my new one or anything like that. They wanted them to just all sound the exact same. So yeah, once it gets out, once it's out the door, it's then it's done.
Okay.
Until then, I'm going to mess with it, you know, until the very last bit.
How many, since you brought it up, how many pedals out there that you've created have that Easter egg that isn't mentioned publicly, but someone may discover hours into using it?
Well, I don't know that I have gotten that far. There's some fun things in the Bubbletron, and there are some fun things in, even in the Dynatrim, in my opinion. I think that kind of thing. But now with the new processor that we use, the Dream processor from France.
Tell me about it. This is a whole new universe for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really fantastic machine. But with this, so it's a Dream processor, and the amount of, you know, memory that we can hook up to it and things like that. I could have something on there that, like, if you turned all the controls up, that the microprocessor would play a little clip of me yelling at you, telling you, don't do that. And it would just come through your speakers. I've been wanting to really do that. Like, if you hold all the buttons and you double tap on this and hold your tongue just right, it'll scream at you. But, I've been trying to, add some features to it that would be hard to detect, but that I could have on my own if I wanted to. Mm-hmm. So that's what's fun about it. This processor gives you 4 DSP engines, so we can run 4 effects in parallel. It's got plenty of inputs and outputs so we can control lights or talk to other microprocessors, and we can set the sound quality on it with our external D2A. And so I became aware of this when we had explored a lot of the, main effects that the Spin microprocessor could do. Spin is an all-in-one device. It's really great for hobbyists and doing digital effects. It's the one that Keith Barr from MXR and Elisa's came up with. Brilliant, brilliant guy. And so he came up with this all-in-one type architecture, and it's just great to play with. It allows you to do so much. And that's how all of our digital effects have been done up until the Echoes. It has limitations since it's an all-in-one package. And so when you move to anything else, you get all kinds of options, and it's just a bigger mountain to climb in terms of starting point. So this one offered the ability for us to create our own sounds on, and that's what was important. We didn't want to use anything that was out of the box, and I didn't like the pricing of things like the Shark or, you know, things like that. Some of the Blackfin processors, they just seemed expensive, and, you know, maybe they aren't, but they seemed expensive. This way is cheaper, and it still gives us clock speeds that are at 200 megahertz. So we can do all kinds of, you know, delicious processing of the sound. So now we don't have any limitations in terms of our program size. That's not a limitation in the Dream. So with the Spin, we were limited to 128 lines of code, which is, you know, essentially you can tell any story you want as long as it's 128 sentences. And that's not the case now. So we can tell much bigger and better stories. So, and it allows, like I said earlier, it allows 4 simultaneous DSP operations. So when I want to experiment with putting an envelope filter and a chorus pedal in parallel to get you the ultimate reggae sound, that's something that we can explore. If I want to explore quadraphonic ideas, I can do it with 4 layers of processing. If I want to do the echoes and run delay and reverb in parallel, I can do that. And it gives you a much different sounds than what people connecting stomp boxes can normally do, unless they have got splitters and mixers. So for me, that those few points there, you know, where I can, it's a DSP that can do, you know, multiple voices, and I can add memory to, and I can you know, write long programs or complex programs and dream up all kinds of, you know, analogish variations and to the sound. It's a great chip, and it's only a few dollars, you know, so it's great like that.
When you look at fellow pedal makers, when you walk around the NAMM show, does Robert Keeley ever think that pedals sometimes are just too complicated, or do you feel like the sky is the limit, and as processors evolve, you can just cram more and more stuff into them? Do you ever see a pedal and just go like, this is cool, but it's not practical? There's just too much going on.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's Empress. That guy is brilliant. Every time I see him, I feel like a, you know, half-wit. And he has got a pedal out that I swear you can control every parameter of every possible effect. And you can wire them all, and, you know, just with your fingertips. And it's, you know, there's something that does too much. I fell in love with this French builder. I think it's Glue Glue. G-L-O-U. And I forgot what his name is. Probably Pierre, but maybe not. And so, at any rate, you know, very, very complicated, you know, $600-$700 envelope filter or phaser or something like that. But yeah, it's way too complicated, you know, but it's beautiful for what it is. For my own designs, I want somebody to feel like they can create music on the fly. I like improvised live music. I like hearing a different story all the time. And so, you know, I want my pedals to be able to create, you know, something that you can be extremely expressive with and, you know, not be tied to some mechanical thing down into your feet. You know, you got to get your head clear so you can daydream. So, you know, that's, I'm not into, you know, 4 delay pedals connected in series with 100 knobs for each one. And it just looks cool because it's a bunch of knobs like a synth or something. That doesn't excite me at all, since, you know, from that very narrow perspective, you know, that doesn't excite me as much as how vocal quality can I get it? Can I make the spring sound more random so that it just, you know, doesn't sound repetitious in my mind, and I can't hear the, you know, limitations of the DSP. I'm much more interested in this, the sound quality and making it so that you can get your voice out than I am in the complexities. The complexities are cool because that's where the engineer comes at. I mean, the complexities are cool, not cool, pain in the butt for everybody around here, because every time I look at a switch, it's just another binary, you know, exponential power, right? Oh, that means I have 2 to the 8 features now I can do. I can allow you to do anything now. So yeah, I kind of battle myself there with these possibilities, but I'm not into it. So I don't think I have to worry about it getting carried away from me.
Yeah. And you mentioned that when you release a product,
remember I'm lazy.
What's that?
Remember I'm lazy, right?
Yeah,
remember
you
I'm
are.
Lazy. The whole premise is, the whole thing is that I'm lazy.
The so, lazy mathematician.
Lord knows I wouldn't want to figure out something.
Yeah. You mentioned fixing mistakes a few times, and then you also said, though, that when a pedal is shipped, you don't want to change it too much. Do mistakes ever rear their head after a product has been released?
Well, sure.
What do those tend to be? Are they things that the rigors of touring that, you know, it just doesn't hold up, a connection is loose, or are they more like we programmed this wrong?
Oh, no, the programming part doesn't happen. The thing that always fails all the time is the electromechanicals and then the power supply, the same as it is for every piece of electronics. The first thing that's going to fail are, you know, things that get hot or things that move. So the light switch, the power switch, the foot switch is going to go bad. Then, you know, things that get hot, if you didn't design the power supply right. Fortunately, we haven't had problems like that. You know, but like, not to pick on any specific pedal builder, but like, here's a classic example, and there's tons of examples in the amp world. Fender might not use the right wattage resistor, and they might get a little, you know, overheated over time. But sure. Like, you know, the Rat pedals had, if you had a bad DC power supply connection or something like that, this little 47 ohm resistor would get hot and char and burn open. So, you know, it's the same stuff with everything else in like you know, the electronics world is, it's the electromechanicals that fail. So, you know, stomp switches always go bad. Then people, you know, break maybe a jack or something like that. So, you know, those things go wrong. But we don't, you know, fortunately, we don't program them wrong. That doesn't happen, you know, fortunately, knock on wood. We don't, the machines that build the surface mount stuff, you know, don't make mistakes like that generally. So, you know, unless some manufacturer sends you the wrong part, you know, you don't, but we have lots of, you know, procedures in place to catch that. The pedal's usually tested 2, 3, 4 times before it goes into a box. But the final test is a audio audition by a person, you know, playing music through the pedal and testing each and every one of the features and combinations. And that's pretty rigorous testing that we do there in terms of, you know, just doesn't, if it doesn't pass, if the stomp switch is too noisy, or if it gave out 1 out of 10 times, it's not working right. So, you know, we recycle it and get it fixed and put it back through testing again. So, you know, that's how that part works.
Does the testing all happen in your facility, or are there musicians out there, artists that you endorse, who are trying out stuff that the world hasn't seen yet?
Oh, that's kind of like two different questions. So every pedal gets tested here.
Sure.
You know, everything gets tested multiple times. But then if you're talking about the development stage, I've usually kept that pretty private, and it's kind of been, in the past, it was always just my ear. And then I kind of told you earlier even how I just kind of opened that up to Aaron Pierce here and helping me, you know, decide what's a great tone and response. And because sometimes, you know, I can, since I'm involved in other stuff, I can be kind of fatigued. I might not be into that style of music right now. I could find myself in the midst of designing a heavy metal pedal going, man, I really like Julian Lage right now, or Tommy Emmanuel, or, you know, I've been listening to a lot of acoustic Jerry Garcia. I'm not really into this, you know, crushing, you know, triple rectifier sound at the moment. So I better get some help here.
Yeah.
Now that I'm, you know, kind of lost in something else. So, yeah, that's how that part works.
You obviously are a huge music fan. You've mentioned all sorts of different kinds of music, from Julian Lage to reggae and classic rock and everything in between. What are you listening to now? What sounds are you currently kind of thinking about in the back of your head?
Well, I just recently kind of went on semi-retirement from a long man crush with Julian Lage. That when I heard those couple records, man, in that live recording in California or somewhere, and then the Modern Lore, and I paid somebody to transcribe the entire album, and so I just fell in love with that, and his dynamics and his voicings, and I mean his rhythms, his blah blah blah. I mean, that was just so mind exploding listening to him. So that's kind of where I've been. You know, I'm always looking at, I hate to call it classic rock, but music from the 60s and 70s, where they got to experiment with sounds and stuff like that, and there was a little bit wider range of music out. There's still so many sounds to explore and to recombine. If you listen to Frank Zappa and stuff like that, there's, you know, ridiculous amounts of time that he spent in the studio crafting sounds. And so, you know, anytime you throw on a Zappa album, you if you're not inspired by the sounds, you're not a musician, you know. So I don't know. I just listen to a variety of stuff. I really enjoy Fish, obviously, and Trey Anastasio. He doesn't say come up with a plethora of sounds necessarily, but the live experience and their live recordings, I find very enjoyable. They're kind of like ear candy. So, and so that's why I enjoy that so much. I like the improv every night. They have a certain language of improv that I, you know, fits me, you know.
Yeah.
So I enjoy it. Just like, you know, Garcia fans, just all the notes just seem right. So, you know, that's my main diet. And then other, you know, kind of health foods come in, like Julian Lage, and you're like, whoa, that was the best antioxidant ever.
But you had to retire from it. It got to be too much.
Well, I mean, I can't even calculate how many times I've listened to it, or I'll be like such a goober. I'll be in my car, take a picture of my dash and send it to him. You know, thinking about you, buddy. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So, yeah. So I got to, you know, I got to meet him once. It was very cool. And he was better live than the live experience was just absolutely ridiculously good. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I think it was with Jorge Roeder and, man, I can't remember the other guy's name, Jason Tubon Drums or something like that. But they were all so good.
Yeah. Was he using one of your pedals?
Yeah. Heck no. He was using my buddy Josh Scott's JHS pedal, the Morning Glory, which is a great sounding pedal. And so, like, I can't, like, complain too much. I do constantly, but I'm not going to tell you that. And so I did make a tuner for him that was close. I think he kind of liked it, but it didn't. His idea for how he wanted to be able to tune live to a 440 concert pitch and stuff like that, I don't know that we got that part perfectly dialed in, but he kind of liked that. And I had a blast designing the little pedals off the little pedal off the Modern Lore graphics and stuff like that. And we got to experiment with something there. It was around the NAMM show time last year, so I was kind of tied up with stuff. And then most recently, when I say that, it's probably been a half a year or so ago, we started talking about he wanted a parametric EQ, something with like four knobs. So he had a frequency and a boost cut range so that he could dial in his tone live. And I said, yeah. As a matter of fact, we're kind of doing that with this Fuzzbender pedal that I have going right now. So I'm like exactly in that mode. I'll get back with you. And then I think he got back from tour and he's like, how's it going? And I'm like, oh my gosh, I forgot all about it. So I have, so I'm glad we're talking about it now because that'll remind me to put some effort in that direction. Hopefully he doesn't hear it until he gets the pedal in his hands. But but he just wants something simple because he had the coolest way of setting his guitar tone. And I found out that he'll play his, guitar through a little. I asked him, why in the world do you have a looper on your board? And I just didn't understand. I was like, I don't hear any looping in your music. And he's like, no, I just play something and then I let that play back while I go out in the audience and listen to how my guitar is EQ'd by the room and all the other forces that be. So
that's brilliant.
I know. And so that's when he said, man, can you make me an EQ? I was like, oh yeah, because that's exactly what you need. You just want to push around two different points and dial it in. It's much better than a tone control on an amp or a guitar pedal. So, you know, heck yeah. So it should be in theory. So I just haven't applied myself to getting that problem with the Julian Lage EQ pedal solved. I really need to address that sooner than later. Because I really would love to be able to, you know, hear our electronics, or maybe not so much hear it, but just know that the electronics were kind of in the signal path of his music, because that stuff's incredible.
It is. How cool.
Absolutely.
You must be getting insane and great ideas from musicians all the time.
That's what happens. That's like the love fest. That's why it's so fun to be in the music effect world, because if I was just, say, building acoustic guitars, there's tons of love, there's tons of passion and creativity in there, but I don't know that they get to combine so many ideas and new ideas and get to daydream and implement those ideas. With sound effects, I mean, you literally can try to make the worst sound you can, and somebody will be like, that was the greatest pedal, I wonder why Keeley doesn't have it on his page anymore. 404 redirect. You know, and because they don't have that pedal up there, that pedal that Robert Keeley tried to make sound bad, you know, why doesn't he sell it anymore? I mean, you can try to be bad and people just like it. You can try to be good and people don't like it. But, you know, making effects and combining sound effects and stuff like that is a really like a full-time exciting thing. Just kind of open your eyes or ears and you can get inspiration from any direction. And because I've, you know, taken the longer, harder route of hiring or educating engineers and doing that, then now I can daydream. You know, I mean, if you're in the beginning of, you know, building in the basement still. It might be harder to see it at that point, but that's where I started.
Sure.
All the same, you know.
I've been fascinated to, you know, I'm friends on Facebook with Zachary Vex, and he's made over the years a solar-powered tube amp, some bug spray, God knows what other things he just hasn't posted about. Does your engineering mind ever go beyond the world of pedals and effects, and are you tinkering with stuff at home that maybe the world doesn't even know about?
Man, Zachary Vex is such a great example of the curiosity it takes to kind of like fully be immersed in the effects world. That's a great guy that started off probably about, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, 6 years advance of me. And I don't know that he's an engineer by trade, but he sure has made himself an engineer. He is an engineer, capital I, capital S, because he does, you know, take a scientific method to his experiments and his creations. And he truly does think unique ideas and create new things. Like you said, it goes from the bug spray. Weren't they setting themselves on fire or something like that?
I think so.
And then, I mean, he got to being snow covered in Minnesota has got to do a lot for your electrical creativity, because it must be too cold outside to do other stuff. So you sit inside daydreaming electric cars and vehicles and working with transmissions and batteries and chargers and then microphones. He's done some absolutely crazy microphone stuff. I have no idea what he's doing. He's crazy. I'm much more lo-fi right now. I am having a blast learning some woodworking stuff, and making simple joints and gluing stuff together is complex enough for me.
Got it. You can finally build those tube amps that you wanted to 20 years ago.
You know what? Now that I know what it takes to build a quality instrument, such as a tube amplifier, to the standards that I'd want, I'm like, oh, that sounds like work. I think I'll do my other hobby that is cooking. So, you know, making bacon and eggs and perfecting bacon and eggs is a lifetime you can take doing sure. that. And so cooking and woodworking is sufficient for me.
All right, we got to get you back on the Truth About Vintage Amps podcast, because we have cooking tips all the time. So,
all right.
Yeah, we'll just have you.
Hey, you know what? There used to be a Honda book, you know, in the 70s that was like how to cook a chicken or a turkey on the, you know, intake manifold
or
the exhaust manifold of your Honda car. You remember that one?
Of course.
And, shouldn't there be, if there isn't, a book on like cooking tips on top of your EL84s or something like that?
You know,
that.
We've covered this. I'm sad to say we've covered this times on our previous episode. And someone said that Lowell George would heat up a sandwich or a burrito behind his amp. But
hey, TBD that does if sound that's familiar true. Now, I think I did get the Lowell George story. I probably got it from one of those Gerald Weber Kendrick Amplifier books. He probably told the story in there. How funny. Yeah.
Final question. Since this pedal community keeps growing and growing, can you talk to me a little bit about it? You'd mentioned JHS. Are you guys always, you know, is everybody friendly? Is there just this camaraderie around it that everyone's rooting for each other? Are you always getting inspired by things you're seeing out in the field?
Yeah, that's an interesting one, man. It is all of those positive things whenever it needs to be. And that's what's the cool thing about it. If I like had a serious question that Josh could help me with on marketing, I'm sure I could give him a call right now and just say, hey, man, what's going on here? And I know that if those guys felt like it, they would give me a call and we would help them. We're constantly, I think, back and forth about, not constantly, but we frequently want to work on projects together, but you have so much going in your own world that sometimes it, you know, makes it difficult. But fortunately, we're not in a place where we're like openly hostile with each other or anything like that. And, you know, the product releases, as soon as I think I have one peer safely behind me in the rearview mirror, I realize that he's actually working with the same stuff I'm working with, and he's got a clever young kid working for him too. And it's like, oh darn, I gotta, I thought I just had you beat, buddy. So now I'm going to have to work extra hard. Smile, smile, wink, wink. You know, so it's like that. I don't know how Mr. Gibson talks to Mr. Fender or Mr. Paul Reed Smith, but at this level, we're happy to be alive and making pedals, which is, I swear to God, one of the funnest jobs ever. So, nope, it is fun. We have good camaraderie. We get along all the times when we're together. So, and there's no, not that I'm aware of, there's no behind the scenes talking bad about the other guy, because I'm sure it would just get around. We're just a bunch of old ladies anyways. So. Yeah.
And the industry, you know what I mean? The industry itself, does it keep growing? Has there been any stagnation, or do you just sell more pedals than you did last year and that just keeps happening right now?
It's a horrible thing, man. Guitar players, when they need a self-help program for employment, they turn to pedals. And I think pedals is one of the healthiest things that a guitar player who's in recovery can do, is to actually do something with their hands and their mind and get back to guitar playing. So, the field is huge. As soon as people realize how fun it is to build a tube amp or a guitar pedal or a acoustic guitar or electric guitar, it's pretty powerful and addicting. Sound effects are so, you know, such a big blanket. It's like a quilt of color and sound that, you know, when you make a fuzz pedal or even a transparent compressor, it's pretty overwhelming sounding. So, and it's, you know, it's not that heavy. And yeah. So you can move around and you can put another battery in it. It's not like, you know, a tube. If you mess up a tube, you're crushed for the day until you get to a store again. So, pedals are great. The field is going to keep on growing. People forever have discovered that there's a lot of fun in making sounds and combining sounds. So, I can see it. I see it as just, you know, more and more years of effects pedal excitement. Yeah. Because there's so many super talented people pushing groups of, you know, 5, 10 to 30, 40, 50, 300 people around, you know, whatever it is. It's very addictive to hear yourself on a record or know that everything that you're hearing from the artist is coming through some piece of equipment that's in their signal chain that you created, and now they're getting more fun from playing it. So, I don't know. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah. Final question. What is Robert Keeley using guitar wise and amp wise to test out all these pedals? Is there a main rig that you kind of turn to for your reference?
Yeah, I really like, I'm sitting closest to this Benson amplifier.
Sure.
And so I like Chris Benson up in Portland. And of course I have a pair of stereo Supros in my bedroom at the house. So if I'm playing guitar there and testing stuff, I'm always listening to that. Cause there's a Keeley Supro amp that David Coltai and I did of Supro amps. So there's a RK model. And I really enjoy that one cause it's flat sounding. It's very efficient and loud. So it's got some great characteristics that are not Fender, which I really like to design on Fender amps. I think a lot of people play Fender amps. And so I kind of get accustomed to how that amplifier sounds and responds. So, that's kind of, you know, a habit of mine to kind of do a lot of play testing of the pedals through Fender with Fender type equipment. But I really enjoy this Benson amp and this Supro amp. Those two of, and of course a Milkman amplifier too. I'm spoiled enough that I got a Milkman by Tim Marcus. So yeah. those four right there pretty much have me. I got a Marshall stack in my room, but it doesn't see much love. So, you know, I like to go the extremes on guitar pickups because I have to understand how the pedal's going to respond if a guy is playing a Telecaster on it or if he's got some, you know, Darth Vader humbuckers. I got to understand if it's going to collapse under that weight. So, so a variety of pickups and guitars exist around here and amplifiers. I just want to, if I play clean a lot, believe it or not, even with so many effects, when I'm playing for enjoyment, I mostly play, you know, with few spare effects. So I get familiar with the amplifier, and I then kind of know how it responds and what its limitations are. If I push the bass too much, I know how it kind of might sound ugly, so I can go, oh, that's just my amplifier, or, oh, no, that's just the pedal.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, Robert, I'm going to let you go back to finishing the Echoes pedal and being lazy.
Yes, Jason, you got me figured out. I am seriously going to get back to being lazy as best I can.
Thank you so much. This was a blast.
Great. You have a great day, sir.